Blog Talk Radio.
Is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. At The World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the greatest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie before us, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does that amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Happy Friday. You know what this is, Stephen?
This is the third show of the week, and this is something we've been working up to, and glad we got to it.
They said we couldn't do it. I don't know who they were saying that, but here we are. The three-show week is occurring. Congratulations to us all. This is, I mean, especially to you listening. Congratulations.
You're welcome. That's all.
Yeah, you're welcome, as always.
By our very presence.
we just do it because of the love. That's the only reason. So, and boy, do we have a fun one tonight. You know, when I come up with a name like Utopia, Zootopia, Schmootopia, the trouble with perfect futures, I'm in the zone. Okay, Stephen? So this is a fun... This is a fun Friday night show, and we're not going to waste any time. We got to jump right into this. We're going to talk about why utopias don't work out. This is a subject that we've talked about before, and I think, you know, the big reason utopias don't work out. If someone were to ask you that, Stephen, how come these great ideas for perfect societies never seem to pan out exactly? What's the overarching reason for that? Would you say, Stephen?
Because top down doesn't work as well as a grassroots, bottom up approach to managing society. It's basically from the end of the last ice age, as people began trading, we talk about, the entrance of greater than human intelligence into the world. Well, perhaps it's already happened in the form of even the first markets. Because, you know, if you went fishing, Phil, imagine that you're on the Mediterranean 10,000 years ago and you're a fisherman. You go fishing and you fish enough and you have enough not only to feed your own family but other people around you. Well, you may end up catching fish that are fed to people that you don't know and are miles and miles away. It's not your brilliance that gets the fish to the people who want it. It's just that there's this market that in some ways starts from the bottom and meets our needs in ways that we can't, no one individual can plan. And these utopias are always, here's the way we're going to do things. We're going to do this, this, and this, and trying to force, square pegs into round holes, and it just never has worked.
I think that's true. Ultimately, what that kind of principle of getting more than what you ask for, kind of the law of accelerating returns is built into that. What we call the human imperative is built into that. Those benefits always seem to derive from individual actions and individual initiative. And as soon as those are not driving it, right? As soon as those become less than central to getting you to your happy outcome, you can't get there. It's like, well, they're taking too long, and it's slow, and people are all acting like individuals, so we don't get to the perfect future. Here, let me lay down the perfect plan, and then as soon as you do, you take away the individual autonomy, the individual actions, the whole thing that's driving getting you to the better outcome. I think that's a very good diagnosis. Stephen.
Well, and have you ever seen or read the book The Giver or seen the movie?
No.
There's kind of a chilling quote. It's a children's book. It's award winning. What's the highest? The Newbery Award, right?
Mm-hmm.
It won that. And it's a dystopian future where everyone's on a drug that basically removes individual will, and those in charge of this have said, we can't afford for people to have freedom. When people are free, then they don't choose the right things, And when people are free to make choices, they'll make the wrong choices. Well, that's what you're battling against with utopias. It's almost always going to be engineered from the top down, and so that's why they historically haven't worked.
Traditional utopias are engineered from the top down, but then you've got more recent ideas about it, post scarcity and. Mm-hmm. I always talk about the Adhocracy Society of Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom, that wonderful novel of a few years back.
If you haven't read that, folks, you've got to read it. That Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom is by Cory Doctorow is an awesome, awesome book.
A fantastic book, and it sets up a utopian society that's not top down, that's completely bottom up, which is the only thing that's not answered is exactly how we got there, right? That's the problem. Because ultimately, even the vision of Karl Marx was a completely bottom-up, free, unencumbered society. But according to him, to get there, right, you had to have this huge incursion of the state first, and you go through those stages. Of course, we never seem to get out of those initial stages. They only get worse. So here we've got this. We've got this story in The Guardian. Automation may mean a post-work society, but we shouldn't be afraid. It's a really interesting kind of cautious take on what, the robots are stealing our jobs is all about. Because, this is a coin with more than one side, more than two sides. When you say, well, if the robots do all the work, yay, we don't have to do any work anymore. And then you say, "Oh no, nobody has a job, right?" I mean,
how am I going? How am I going to afford, to eat in all this free time I have? So yeah.
So there, there's the possibility of a utopia when the robots do all the work, but something's got to give. The society has to organize itself around something other than the economic output or the productive output of the individual results in their ability to participate in the economy, because you can't have both. You can't have the robots doing everything and then us doing something that's worth drawing a salary. So, that's a conundrum that we've faced on this show. We've talked about it any number of times, and we're not going to get into it tonight just because...
Some of the best discussion we've had on that was when we had Martin Ford on the show.
Talking about his book, The Lights in the Tunnel. And I would recommend that book to anyone curious about this. I think he's had a subsequent book, and we're going to have him back at some point to talk about that. But I want to stay off that for now, because what I found interesting in this article by Paul Mason is he references a guy I had never heard of, a utopian socialist from the 19th century, a guy named Charles Fourier. And he talks about this future where work could become play, where it takes on all the attributes of fun, and what we do is all about variety. So there's still no clear way that work that's play can get you paid, right, and can make you economically viable. But it's it's an interesting notion to kind of add to the mix. It's like, okay, well, we get some of the ingredients for a utopia without exactly knowing for sure how we're going to get to it. Then I want to contrast that with this other story, the one that was on Inverse.com. The future startup sui generis is Uber, but for techno-socialist city-states. So, socialism is just, it's all over this this discussion. You can't talk about utopias without talking about socialism. You know, it's just,
right.
It's going to come up. And we're okay.
And the most common answer, if you ask people, well, how do we deal with a future where everything's automated and nobody has jobs? The universal basic income is the model that people bring up. You're a citizen of the country. The country has a high GDP because AIs and robots are producing as much and more than we ever did. And you can tax any tax those robots. They don't care. You know,
what are they going to do with the money?
Yeah, that's right. So that income gets redistributed in large part to the citizens at some subsistence wage or probably much higher. And at some point, you would want to also have a system, particularly since you brought up Uber. There are ways that people can benefit one another, that you can have various Uber models that would allow people to earn a little more, even in a very highly automated society, you know?
Right, and that's where these guys come in. This is what's interesting to me about sui generis. They look at Singapore and they say, here's what we want to do. We want to create a bunch of Singapores. Okay, we want to create city-states that are basically corporate entities, and everybody in the city-state works for this corporation. This corporation is all about profit, but not everything that goes on in that city-state is dedicated to the one or multiple, whatever they would be, like major franchises or industries or whatever that are driving the profit. They would also want to attract the right kind of people who would also attract other productive people in. They'd want artists there and stuff like that. So that would be part of the mix. And then they also talk about this idea of, well, there's just be a lot of public work that would have to be done in maintaining the city-state. And so you would have this, they introduced this idea of an Uber-like app that would allow people to who aren't on the high income side of the equation, because obviously some people living in this city state are going to be big producers, big earners. They're going to be doing great. That's kind of like the first order that they want to bring in. But for people who aren't there, they can go out and they can serve their neighbors. They can serve their community and they get paid too. And it would be on a model like Uber. They would, the app would help them hook themselves up with work that is a good fit for them. They could do it when they want to, and it could be as much or as little as they want to do in order to have the income that they need to survive. Well, I like that idea, kind of separated from the whole idea of the socialist city-state, which I think is, maybe. I don't know. I'll have to read up on it more to see if there's really some good reason for going in that direction. I mean, these things kind of remind me of, what do you call those, the floating ones, I can't think of it. The people create.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. You're talking about the guys that are out there.
We'll think of it in a minute. Anyway.
It'll come to us in a minute. But the guys are setting up
seasteads.
Like, seasteads.
It's kind of like seasteads where they would gain, but they don't have to be at sea. They would gain some form of sovereignty, even on land, separate from whatever government is surrounding them. And the only government here would be the corporate. The corporate body. Well, interesting model. Doesn't feel all that utopian to me, frankly. It feels like a potential model for a working society. Not too different from how Singapore works, really. And it might produce some good ends. But I like that they're doing.
It also sounds like RoboCop's Detroit. So maybe not.
it sounds a little bit like that, but. But maybe we'll have these guys on at some point, and they'll explain it to us better, and we'll be totally sold on the idea.
Perhaps I'm being unfair, but
but I like the Uber idea, you were talking the same, along the same lines. Because to me, the big problem with universal basic income is it undoes the bottom-up thing in the same way that that the control thing does. It's just another form of control. Because if people just get the money, they're not doing anything, right? They're not fulfilling that basic function of humanity, which is to make things better, to improve things. I think that a standalone universal basic income system will fail because potentially will fail because it's not meaningful enough. It's not providing meaning into people's lives. But something like that Uber app, well, maybe that could. And something like the idea of making play into work, maybe that could too. Where
you got to get up in the morning and you need to have something that excites you about the day. You know,
right?
Something to go and do and devote yourself to and pour yourself into, and it can't be just walking to the mailbox to pick up the check for universal basic income.
Right. You need to do something that makes you feel like you've earned your universal basic income. I actually feel that without some participation, without some skin in the game, I don't know, life just feels very detached to me. But it doesn't have to be wage slavery. It doesn't have to be drudgery. It doesn't have to be people doing things they don't want to do or being unhappy or uncomfortable. Ultimately, it could be people doing exactly what they want to do and being paid for that. That would be the ideal. That would be the utopian outcome. I don't see anybody calling for exactly that because that's hard to pull off too. Well, who decides, right? How do you assign it? It's almost like you would need AIs to be sorting all this out and making the equation work. But to me, those kinds of ideas start to push us in a more workable utopian direction. If we're going to use the word, right? If we're going to use the word utopia, I think that a post-work world is potentially utopian, potentially a good world to live in, if work has been replaced by something equally meaningful and important, and only providing us the benefits without a lot of the problems that we currently have. I know that's I'm speaking in very vague terms, but you get the idea, right? We're talking about getting past all the drudgery. Yeah, the robots have taken that on, but not getting to this point where we've become detached from the process. And one thing that the city-state guys have going for them is that you're still attached. You know, you're always going to be very much attached to whatever it is that this the city-state is trying to do. I don't know. It sounds like a pretty high-pressure environment to me. Maybe I'm getting too old. I've got retirement in my sights. But this brings us to our other utopia that I want to talk about tonight, and the other reason that utopias don't work, which gets overlooked. And I think everything we've said up to this point is true, just in terms of how they can be implemented and the fact that there's just major incentive problems that are always going to arise whenever you talk about a utopia. But I want to talk briefly about the movie Zootopia, which is not presented as anybody's idea of a potential utopian future, except for to the characters within it. For those who haven't seen it, and Stephen, I believe you're among them.
Right. You texted me, Phil, that you thought it'd be a good one to take the family to. So, what's going on in that movie?
I highly recommend Zootopia on a couple of grounds. One is I think it's a really fun movie. So basically, take the animals out of it, and you've got a story of this young cop, for all intents and purposes, the first woman on the force, stumbles, she gets assigned to parking duty. This could have been a movie in the 80s. Could have been like a comedy, buddy, comedy partner, cop movie. She gets assigned to parking duty. She stumbles upon this huge case and ends up having to partner with this grifter con artist guy in order to track down what's really happening. You know, just from that setup, you say, okay, well, that sounds like a pretty standard Hollywood movie. And it's well executed on those grounds, and it works on those grounds. But now you add to it that it takes place in this world where she's not the first woman on the force. She's the first rabbit on the force, actually. And it's because it's in a world of anthropomorphic animals. It's basically in this world, the mammals have all evolved to a pretty human-type state, and they're living in peace with each other. The predators have stopped preying on the prey, and, you know, the lion lays down with the lamb. Everybody gets along great. So it's this interesting utopian vision of the future for animals, and yet everything's not.
I'm sorry, Phil. The lion lays down with the lamb, and not that there's anything wrong with it.
Not that there's anything wrong with that, you know.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Socratic, no.
The Platonic way. Yeah.
Platonic way, thank you, Socratic.
Okay.
Yeah, the line asked.
It's a kid's show, guys. It's,
come on, knock it off. And that's from the Bible, by the way.
Straighten
so
yourself
back
up.
Yeah, anyway, so here you are. Here you got this wonderful world of peace among the animals, but things are still not perfect. And you know the reason things aren't perfect in Zootopia is the reason ultimately that things won't be perfect in any of our utopias either. And that reason is that we still bring our basically limited nature with us into whatever setting we go into, right? We're not perfect, right? How are we ever going to make a perfect world? That's the big problem with utopias, right? Until people are perfect, any world we make is not going to be perfect. And, you know, this is the harsh lesson that that this kind of naive rabbit, very idealistic rabbit who moves from the farm and goes to live in Zootopia, you know, the city of dreams, you know, where all animals live in peace together. You know, she's a cop and obviously has to experience what life is really all about.
I think it's probably a minister or something said one time that, you know, there's no such thing as a perfect vacation because you could travel 1,000 miles and, you know, look in the mirror and it's still you.
Right.
You carry your own problems with you,
right?
Wherever you go. And so I guess that's going to be the case. Any society that we can possibly imagine is going to be imperfect because it's going to be made up of imperfect people. So
that's right. And I think that one of the real charms of the movie is that they recognize that and they give voice to that the imperfect nature of the world. Well, you know what? If you need cops, obviously it's not a perfect world, right?
Right.
You know, going in that the world is still not quite perfect. But one of the things that goes on in there, and my wife and I were discussing this on the way home because I really enjoyed the movie a lot. But one thing that kind of hung in the back of my head was there appears to be kind of a belabored and almost tortured metaphor about racism going on in it. And
yeah.
I can't decide whose side they're on or what they mean by it. And in fact, I started reading up on what other people thought, and I've seen, it's very interesting, people on the right who are horribly offended by it and people on the left who are terribly offended by it. So I'm thinking, okay, well, if they must have either really screwed up or they're doing something right. You know,
we have a movie that's created mutual dissatisfaction. Maybe it's the perfect movie.
But yeah, it could be that it's the perfect movie. It could be that they tried too hard with that, because my initial response was to say they could have dialed that back a little. That's an interesting
right.
message, but they could have dialed it back a little. But one of the crazy things I read is have you ever heard the theory that the U.S. government actually invented crack cocaine in order
it's part of what's called liberation theology. Particularly black churches and things in various places that kind of have taken on kind of a militant stand. That's one of the things that they talk about a lot, is that it was created by the CIA or some entity within the U.S. government to keep certain segments of the population down.
Wow.
Is that in the movie?
Who claim that this movie espouses that theory. Okay.
Really?
And
really?
Is actually acting
that?
Out that theory. What's that?
Did you see that theory is in
no,
there?
No, I see the connection they're making, but I think it's absurd. I don't think
okay.
a Disney movie would roll out that theory. Especially not, I mean, if you see the story, you go, no, that's not what, I don't believe it. I don't believe that's what they're doing. There's also criticism that, I'm just talking about some of the things that people are saying about the movie before I say my own weird thing about it. People are saying that this movie is just a big outreach to the furry community, and this is a big advertisement for them. Okay, so.
All right.
And you're familiar with the furry community.
Yeah, unfortunately, I know what that is. Yeah, that's cool.
So I don't believe it's that either. But
yeah.
I will say it's this. It's an amazingly transhumanist movie, okay?
Okay.
Because basically you've got the whole idea of animal uplift in this film. Now, in this movie, there were no human. There's no humans in it. There's no. If humans ever lived in this world, they're irrelevant. And, yeah, they went away. I don't know what happened to them. But these animals uplift.
Yeah.
What's that?
Hopefully, they transcended. You know.
Yeah, they must have transcended. But the animals uplifted themselves. Nobody else uplifted them. They uplifted themselves, which to me is a tremendous analogy to us, right? These animals overcame their kind of herd nature or their predatory nature, and they became this one kind of civilization of animals that really works. Notwithstanding that there's some problems, but they evolved themselves into something really amazing. And when you get to Zootopia the first time, it's right up there with Avatar. In fact, I want to go back and see the movie in 3D just to see those. Scenes of Zootopia when you get there. It's, you know, there's all these different ecosystems within the city. You know, there's the tundra with the polar bears, and there's the desert, and there's the tropical rainforest. And it's so well executed. The animation is just is so wonderful. And it's just this great portrayal of this world that these beings have created for themselves. Having, kind of stepped up to the next stage, right? So,
right.
Yeah, animal uplift is in there, but also I feel like it's talking a little bit about human uplift. At least that's what I took away from it, and I think that's as reasonable as that it's a big nod to furries or that it has something to do with the crazy crack theory. And that's what I really liked about it, especially when you take that idea coupled with the recognition that here we are in perfect land, but it's still not perfect because we're still not perfect. So it's this great combination of recognizing that we can be better and that, betterness can be achieved, but we're still not perfect and we've still got a long way to go. On both of those scores, I feel like it really delivers, and it's an outstanding movie.
There is a important message in this that, you should never let the perfect be the enemy of the good, right?
That's right.
If you can take a step that's positive, don't allow the fact that it doesn't you don't arrive at perfection to stand in the way of doing something that betters you in some way. No one's ever going to arrive at perfection in this world. I mean, you do the best you can do, and so you're always striving to do better. And I think that's an important message, not just for kids, but for everybody.
And it's a great message to end with. Absolutely.
Yep.
Better is achievable, by golly. So let's let's get better. You know what? Let's get better all the time.
All the time.
And on that note, Stephen, we've concluded our three-show week. Congratulations to you.
Thanks, Bill. It's been fun. This has been a fun week.
We look forward to doing it again next week. Thank you all for being with us. And until next time, live to see it.